Hey Tacoma, what's up? John Doherty here for Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate, always respectfully and sometimes even optimistically. I'm not saying anything profound when I say that in terms of the future of our climate, the election coming up in November of this year is going to be critical. If climate change deniers gain the upper hand in even just one of the branches of Congress, we'll be in more trouble climate-wise than we're in now. But it's just not the big federal elections that matter. Elections matter all up and down the line, from mayor of the smallest town to state governors and legislatures and everything else in between. We need to have climate-aware politicians guiding our policies and legislation at every level. Today we're going to be talking with just such a candidate. That's Robin Denson. She's presently on the Gig Harbor City Council and is running for Pierce County Council District 7. The incumbent, Derek Young, is term limited out, and thus the opening. Robin Denson has lived in Pierce County for years and has a very, very long record of public service, both in the business world, in nonprofit organizations, on governmental commissions, and as an elected office holder. Part of her record reflects a deep and abiding devotion to caring for our environment in a way that promotes healthy and vibrant communities, always taking into consideration the needs and concerns of all stakeholders. I'm pleased to have her with us today, so here we go with that conversation. We're really delighted to have Robin Denson with us today. She's a candidate for Pierce County Council District 7. Robin, greetings. Welcome.
Well, thank you, John. It's an honor to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Yeah, well, okay. I guess it's an honor all the way around then, because I'm just really thrilled to have you here. So let's just start off by, why don't you give us a brief background, who you are, what you've been up to for the last 5-10 years, and why you're running for Pierce County Council.
All right. Well, thank you, John. So as you mentioned, I'm Robin Denson. I am the mother of two teenagers. One is now a second driver in our house. So I'm very excited about that. Very helpful. And I've lived in Gig Harbor for many years. Both my kids have been born and raised here. We love the Pacific Northwest. And one of the things we love about it is the incredible environment that we're grateful to live in, which I know is one of the things we're going to talk about today. I am a current Gig Harbor City Council person, and it's just a huge honor to serve this beautiful and unique maritime city. I've been doing that for, let's see, I'm on my third year now and have accomplished quite a bit. Still lots to do, and things take time, but I've gotten into the rhythm of getting things done in government. And one of the things I pride myself on is really being able to bring people together and work towards common goals. We sometimes might have different ideas about how to get to goals, but typically our objectives are similar or hopefully the same. And I love bringing people together and finding the best strategies to accomplish wonderful things for our people, for our lands, for our waters. One of the things that helped me get elected is that I've always been known as somebody who is just super involved in our community and in every aspect. I'm a small business owner myself. I started my career in economic development, so I love being involved with our small business community and large business community. We, you know, there's a place and a purpose for all of us. I'm involved in the chamber and our Main Street Association. I'm very involved in environmental causes. I helped start a nonprofit here many years ago called Harbor Wild Watch. And if you are not aware of them, they are amazing. I was on their founding board, and now I am just an amazed observer. They have grown and are providing programs, I mean, throughout the world now, digitally, but certainly very actively and in a physical sense throughout the Puget Sound. So they are just incredible. There's lots of opportunities to get involved with them too. Happy to talk about them forever. And then in terms of my work here with the city, I was a volunteer parks commissioner for 4 terms. They could not get rid of me. I loved that job. And because of that, I was appointed by the Pierce County Council to serve on the Conservation Futures Citizens Advisory Board, which I still consider one of my greatest honors because we are able, or we were able, I had to get off once I got elected to city council, but that group, together with the county council, conserves land for conservation, for habitat, for farmland, to keep our rural farmland working and rural land forever and ever, and then urban parks and recreation opportunities as well. So for perpetuity, we're able to conserve some of the most beautiful lands in Pierce County, which just makes it so special to live here. And like I mentioned, I had to step off that committee when I got elected to public office. But since I've been able to work on the other side as a city council person, applying for grants through the Conservation Futures Program. And so far, we've secured two of those to conserve over 35 acres of really critical streamside habitat for an important salmon stream here in Gig Harbor. So being involved in the community for early childhood things through communities and schools, through environment, through business, I'm interested in everything that makes a community healthy and work well. And I think that that helped me get elected with a really good majority a couple years ago, because I was known kind of throughout the community as somebody who didn't just talk, but dug in, did the work and got things done.
Yeah, well, I can certainly pick up your enthusiasm and your energy. And it's easy for me to believe that that's part of your political success. Now, in talking about some of the stuff you've been involved with, I heard you say business or small business. I also heard you say environment several times. So I just want to take a quick look at that. I would say looking at things in, let's say, a somewhat of a traditional way, we would say that business tends to be a little edgy about environmental issues. In other words, if green space is saved, for instance, then that might irritate somebody who would like to develop that space. If there are restrictions on what can be built in certain areas, some people are going to push back on that. So first off, I guess I'll ask, do you see that there is somewhat of a stress between concern for the environment and business, including small businesses? And if there is some stress there, how do you bridge that?
I think it's complicated, and I hate to paint everybody with one brush. Just like sometimes there could be a stereotype that all business owners are extremely conservative and all they care about is money, money, money. That's not true. I'm a business owner. I have, loftier goals and ambitions in terms of what I think I want to accomplish in life or how I want to contribute to the community. And I know there's a lot of business owners that feel the same way. Now, there certainly are some business owners, I would say some developers, not all developers, but some developers, I mean, they are in the business to develop housing or commercial properties. That's what they do. So they might have some angst, or they might push back a bit about conservation of some properties. I know some real estate entities, and again, not all, some developers, and again, not all, push back on the Growth Management Act a lot for those reasons. But there's others too that absolutely understand that we need to take a long-term look at these things. And while just opening up everything to development might make certain people a lot of money in the short term, over the long run, it's not going to be good for our economy. It's not going to be good for our communities. It's not going to create the kind of communities that people want to live in or can live in without extremely high taxes, for example. They recognize, hopefully, taking a longer term view, that it's more efficient and it's more environmentally healthy, which is good for all of us, to have the bulk of the population living in areas where there's jobs, where there's transit, where there's services like police and fire and schools and parks. It's most efficient for the majority of people to be in those areas. That's not for everybody. And we respect everybody's choices. But I think when you're designing for long-term sustainability, that's the vision that the state has had in mind. And I'm appreciative. And I guess what I try to do is really open the doors to communication with all entities, including business owners. And to tell you the truth, while you get some of the same voices that are just let us do whatever we want and let us build wherever we want, I would say for the most part, individuals, especially small business owners, they care about the character of the community. They're there perhaps like in our downtown Gig Harbor. They know that their small business, which might be tourist supported, depends on having a beautiful harbor with lots of trees. It depends on our fishing fleet, having a place to moor their boats and having a vibrant fishing harvest that's available, which is why it's, you know, one of the reasons it's so important to have a good salmon population. So I think most people are able to see the bigger picture and can support those causes if it's really explained and if they feel part of the process and respected in that conversation.
Yeah, so I hear you in terms of it's not simple, but it is doable with thoughtfulness and some energy. And I heard you contrast short-term and long-term several times there. And I think it really is true that successful communities and successful businesses both are more successful if they do take the long-term view of things rather than the short-term, both politically and economically and business-wise. So
yes, I would say it's important that folks think long-term, not short-term, and also that folks are thinking of the community and not just themselves. So if you're thinking of the health of the community, the longevity, the sustainability, what we want our communities to look like in 10, 20, 50, 100 years, that bigger, more generous view is really what's going to keep Pierce County beautiful and healthy for the long term.
So you've been talking a lot about Gig Harbor, which is totally natural since a lot of the work that you've been doing has been in Gig Harbor and you live in Gig Harbor. A big chunk of your district, if elected, is going to be in Tacoma. So how are the lessons or the experiences that you had in Gig Harbor, how are they going to be applicable in when you spread your area of interest out into Tacoma?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm very fortunate that a good chunk of District 7 is in a portion of Tacoma that so far, with me knocking on doors, is very interested in environmental issues. They're very interested in clean air, clean water. Some of them can see Commencement Bay right there, or they're close enough that they can walk down the hill to it. So they're very sensitive to those issues, and they know that it needs to be part of the conversation in terms of, you know, retaining the health of their communities. But, you know, even though I'll be representing District 7, I'll also be working for the entire Pierce County. Mm-hmm. And given my work with the Conservation Futures Program, I've had the opportunity to travel all over Pierce County and look at farmland and look at land that is perfect for habitat conservation. So environmentally, there is so much potential because of the diverse environmental habitat we have in Pierce County. And it's so important to hold on to that while we develop our population centers and we increase affordable and attainable housing, especially transit oriented in those population centers. That plays into and helps us conserve land in those sensitive areas.
Yeah, so I'm one of those guys that you're talking about who live up in the north end of Tacoma and cares deeply about the environment. And I can see, I can see the Narrows from my house, and I love looking at that. And I love this beautiful country we live in. I've lived in Pierce County with one gap since the 1970s. So I do love this part of the world. And we have so much beauty here that's so worth going to the effort to preserve and not only preserve, but bring back stuff that can be brought back. When I was looking over some of your resume, you were involved with an organization called Gig Harbor Land Conservation Fund. Could you just explain a bit what that's all about?
Yes, and that could impact you, actually. If you're looking over the Narrows and towards the Kitsap Peninsula, where you've got Gig Harbor and the Key Peninsula, this very well could have an impact on your view someday, John. So this is brand new. The Gig Harbor Land Conservation Fund was something I launched with some other friends and similarly minded folks in this community to do what we can now to hold on to critical habitat and open space that the community would really value. The city of Gig Harbor and our urban growth area has exploded in population over the last 10 years, like a growth rate of 69%. It's just been amazing. When I moved here in 2004, I think we had under 5,000 people, and now we're over 12,000 people. So, and again, you know, we did need to grow per our Growth Management Act growth targets. So, you know, I'm not bashing that growth at all. We've welcomed all sorts of new, wonderful people into our community. But we really have recognized that we need to make sure we're keeping a balance and we're making sure that we still have land available for our wildlife corridors, that we're not overdeveloping near our salmon streams. And we've got, you know, two in particular and some smaller tributary, really, really healthy salmon streams. And, you know, we've had them inventoried by wild fish and DNR. And yet, right along the streamside forest banks, you know, upland of these streams are these housing developments just clear cutting, and we're having all sorts of sediment. We've had issues and we'd like to prevent issues in the future. So anyway, this Land Conservation Fund was actually inspired by the Conservation Futures Program, because when I helped the city of Gig Harbor write a couple grants to the Conservation Fund to purchase some land near one of these salmon streams, you know, we learned that we needed a match for the county funds. We needed at least 10%. The Puyallup tribe joined in on the first project and funded the entire match, like without a question. They knew this was that important to them in terms of the health of the salmon population. And it was wonderful. But we knew in the future, the tribe might not be willing or able to step up every time with that match. So we wanted to have a fund ready to go that the community could contribute to. So when an opportunity to conserve a piece of land came up anywhere in Gig Harbor or the Key Peninsula, because, you know, growth is going everywhere. We're looking at this whole area. We want to say, yes, we can provide the match, or we can provide part of that match, and we can rally the neighbors, and we can rally the businesses and the organizations to come around some of this critical land. So as you look across the passage and across on the other side of the bridge and see some of those shoreline areas, those are some of the areas that we're interested in, shoreline, creeks, or just bulk pieces of land that we know are wildlife habitat throughout this whole area.
So if I understand correctly, then this is really a non-governmental project. Is that right?
Oh, totally. Yes. Yes. It's a nonprofit fund. We are not a nonprofit ourselves because nobody wanted to bite that project. But we collaborated with the Greater Tacoma Community Foundation. They manage hundreds of funds. So we're one of their funds, and we've got, you know, our own line item and all of that. And you can donate to that fund and you get your tax write-off, and almost 100% of that money goes towards land conservation. They take like 1.25% for their administrative funds. We personally do not get any administrative funds, so we're trying to figure out how we promote and how we do things. But we'll figure that out. And there's so many generous people in this community that care about keeping trees, and they care about the wildlife, and they really care about the salmon, that we'll make it work.
So do you see any potential for that concept to spread further out into the larger Pierce County area?
Well, it certainly could. It's a very simple concept. Anybody could start one of these funds and, you know, get some friends together and talk to the Tacoma Foundation or any community foundation and do this. And I know that there's some other just family funds or business foundations that, you know, we certainly could appeal to if we had a project and we couldn't fund the whole match ourselves. But yeah, if anybody is out there and would like to start something like this in your area, feel free to let me know, because we made plenty of mistakes and we've tried a couple things, and I think we've figured out something that really works, and we're happy to share what we've learned.
Yeah, excellent. So we've been talking, for lack of a better term, also we've been talking about environmentalism on the local or micro level here. This program is about climate change primarily. And so that's kind of the macro thing. And In a sense, we could just say, well, it's such a big issue and it's a global issue, it's got nothing to do with us here. What would you say to somebody that said that?
Oh, I hear it all the time, and it is so not true, because it's all of the quote unquote little things that we don't think are little things, but in the scheme of things might seem like it. It's all of those things that add up. And one example I'll give is that I was in a city council meeting, and it was several months ago, and someone was complaining because the state had just passed passed the plastic bag ban like a year ago, but it had just gone into effect. And the person was saying, why did we bother passing our own ban earlier? We could have just waited, and then we wouldn't have wasted all that staff time. And a couple of us were like, wait. I think it's because cities like Gig Harbor, and certainly there's other cities that are even doing way more than we are, they're dipping their toe in, they're trying things, they're figuring things out. And we weren't the only city that passed a plastic bag ban. We, along with several other cities, you know, have having it on the books, I'm sure influenced the state's decision to say, okay, they've tried it, it worked. If things didn't fall apart, the grocery stores were sort of still able to sell food. We've worked this out. Let's try it on a state level. So I think, you know, local governments and local entities can really influence state policy, which then can influence federal policy.
Yeah, so I would, that's a great example, by the way, that, you know, if the local jurisdictions all around the world take the attitude, oh, let somebody else do it, then that's a bad thing. If local jurisdictions around the world say, well, we're going to do our bit, then that's a good thing. So in terms of, well, let's see, there's two ways we can look at climate change, adaptation and mitigation. And let's just talk about the adaptation piece just a second here first.
Can I add one thing, actually, John, before you move on to adaptation?
Sure.
Is I just want to give a lot of credit to our current county council for the efforts that they have made with climate change. I mean, they've passed this massive sustainability plan, which really was an inspiration to local governments like Gig Harbor to say, hey, let's look at this. Let's look at what Tacoma did too and some of these other cities and see what will work for our community as well. I know for as one small example of something the county did that I thought was really easy, low-hanging fruit, and something hopefully we can do as well, is they're requiring all builders of new homes to install the electric vehicle, the EV outlet. Easy, right? And I think it's pretty cheap for developers to put this in. Very simple. And it opens the door to somebody who's a new homeowner and they're thinking, do I get an electric vehicle or not? And instead of having to factor in, oh, I'm going to have to pay $1,200 for this outlet. No, the outlet's already there. That's one small thing that can maybe push them a little bit over the edge to move towards an electric vehicle. And it's something that, you know, I would love to discuss with our city council too. So things like that, because of the county sustainability plan, you know, are that helps us as a city too. When we can see the county doing things, we're like, okay, on our level, we could do something that we can line up with them.
Yeah. Okay. Well, actually you anticipated where I wanted to go next with this. So that's serendipitous. The way I would have phrased my question would be, do you think that Pierce County is taking climate change seriously? And it sounds like you think they are. So where would you want to take Pierce County moving forward in terms of climate change, both mitigation and adaptation, further than what they're doing? Because we're, you know, clearly, okay, we're doing a fairly good job so far, but it's not the end of the story.
Well, we can always do more, and I'm sure that the county council or the majority of the county council would agree on that. I will say they've really accomplished so much in the last few years in terms of the recognition and the public recognition of climate change as being an emergency, the creation of this plan. They're brand new into this plan, so I know that there's going to be a lot coming in terms of individual measures to that they can actually be measured and that we can see a difference in the future. So I'm very optimistic and I'm excited, so excited to work with the county council and I'm figuring out, okay, we've got these goals. What are the different things that we can do that we can actually implement? Action steps. I love action that we can implement so that we can actually make a positive difference. So I'm not the expert on this, and I do like to look at what other cities and counties are doing. And you know, I don't like to reinvent the wheel because a lot of times, you know, there are unintended consequences. There are things you don't think about when you implement new policy. So it's great when somebody else has worked out some of that. If not, you know, I also don't have a problem being at the forefront and saying, hey, we're going to try this and we can tweak as we go along and make sure it works for everybody. So I'm happy to talk with all the council members, as well as all of our local environmental experts and people that may not be a professional expert, but really have studied a lot in this field to look at all of those ideas, because it is an emergency. We need kind of no hold bar approach to attacking the emergency of climate change. And really, a public official, I would say, you know, our number one job is protecting our people. And if we don't have clean air for them to breathe and clean water for them to drink, and if we don't have soil and temperatures that are conducive to growing food, I mean, to me, it gets pretty basic there. And what we've seen, gosh, even this spring with the floods. And oh my goodness, last summer with those hot temperatures, people died. I mean, there were some people that could not survive in those temperatures, and they could have gone even higher. I hope that was a wake-up call for everyone that this is not a touchy-feely, you know, granola movement. This is real, and it's affecting all of us no matter what side of the aisle you are on. So that is in terms of ways to approach the issue. Like you mentioned, we do need to look at adaptation and resiliency because, unfortunately, there has been climate change. It's ongoing. You know, we're hoping to curb it as much as we can. But I think I read some articles in the last couple of weeks that sea levels, no matter what we do, sea levels are going to rise by a certain amount. It's too late to hold some of that back. So we need to work on resiliency within our communities, making sure we're building for that, making sure we're building where. Where is a good idea to build because of sea level, because of rain? You know, we're having more landslide issues. We're having more flood issues. So we need to make sure that we're planning again long term to make sure that people and property is safe.
Yeah. So one of the things that you commented on was actions versus promises. And, you know, as an observer, I see a lot of times it feels like the political process says, well, we're going to set this goal, or we're going to promise this, or blah, blah, blah. And then as time passes, it doesn't happen. So I really love your approach of like, okay, but let's study, but let's take actions too. So one of the things, here's a real specific I wanted to ask your thoughts on, and that is about, there's a lot of buzz about building codes requiring fossil fuel free new residential construction. What, so, i.e., that basically means electric heat, cooking, air conditioning, and those kind of things. So, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, again, I will say I'm not the expert, but I'm hearing about this, obviously, as are we all. I had a discussion this morning with a gentleman out on the Key Peninsula who is switching all of his, he has like lots of land and trees, and he's switching all of his equipment to electric. He was telling me about this new electric chainsaw that he has now that works so well. And he said, well, goodness, California's going that way. We can do it too. So I do think we're moving in that direction. It's going to be a challenge for some industries, but with fossil fuels, again, taking that long-term view, I hope for everybody, the writing is on the wall. We're seeing where we're going. We're seeing where we need to go. We need to set that expectation. To some extent, we may need to help some of the businesses along, whether it's incentives or helping them plan for this, maybe helping them train employees in some of the new green jobs, making sure we've got open spaces for that conversation and for that work. I'm not opposed to that. We know we need everybody in this together, but I think that what we've heard about electrification of our appliances, and I know there's a lot of people that can't imagine not cooking without a gas stove. Like people like their gas stoves. I do too. So in some extent, it's going to be kind of a cultural shift as well, and just getting used to something new. But I think when you can talk about the purpose and the benefits for all of us and our children and our children's children, then I think people will. Over time, come to terms with that.
So you just brought up something that's near and dear to my heart, and that's cooking. and historically, I was with you fully, 100%. I got to have gas to cook over. And people who cook over gas understand what I'm talking about.
I hear it all the time.
But I tell you what, about 3 months ago, I put an electric induction range in my house. And it is fantastic to cook on it. The temperature is as controllable or more controllable as a gas range. And it's extremely fast. I mean, I can boil water on this induction stove twice as fast as I could over gas. So, they've been using induction ranges in Japan and Europe where energy is expensive for a long time. In fact, first time I went to Europe and I had a rented apartment and I'm like, what the heck is this? And I was really irritated at this induction stove because there is a little learning curve to it. But anyway, folks who are A, concerned about greenhouse gas emissions and B, love cooking on gas, I really encourage you to take a a good look at induction ranges. They're price competitive, and they cost a lot less to run than the gas ranges do. So anyway,
well, see, I did not know that. And see, if we can talk to people about the alternatives, I mean, technology is moving fast. We are developing newer, safer, more environmentally friendly fuels, or I should say energy sources, mm-hmm. like what you just talked about. There may be things from other countries that we could be looking at. I remember I had a fellowship in public policy in New Zealand. This was like 10 years ago or something. And they had one of those mini electric mini split systems on the wall that mm-hmm. you know, provided heat. And I'm like, what the heck is that? Yeah. And that, I mean, this was a long time ago. And now I am seeing them in homes all over in the United States too, because they're less expensive and they work. So I think that there are alternatives. We just kind of have to adapt. We have to get used to these new things. And I know we can do it.
Yeah, I think you make a really important point there, because I think the mythology is that we get to have a good lifestyle or we get to have a good environment at one or the other. But it's not like that. I mean, there are so many changes that we can make. I have an electric vehicle. I love my electric vehicle. And there's so many things that I love about it. And so I don't feel like I gave up anything by switching from a fossil fuel vehicle to an electric vehicle. Same thing with my induction stovetop. So if we are willing, and this is exactly where I hear you taking us, if we're willing to open up to ideas, we can find out that the future can really, it can be both environmentally strong and joyful to live in. So
absolutely. And what you just said about some people thinking that there's a trade-off between a healthy environment and a good lifestyle. I mean, to me, of course, I love the outdoors. I yeah. love to hike. I love to backpack. But to me, a good lifestyle is having, you know, beautiful nature to go enjoy and having fresh air to breathe so that we're all healthier and we feel better. And I mean, that's quality of life to me. Now, one thing I'll mention is an issue that I think we really need to work on is, you know, some of these new technologies, your induction stove, these, you know, mini split systems, these are your electric vehicle. These are not without costs. So I would say if money is not an issue, there's probably all sorts of alternatives for people to achieve the lifestyle that they want without much hardship. Now, our communities that are lower income, that might be a little bit more difficult for them. Maybe they have an old car that's not super fuel efficient, but they can't just go out and buy a new car right. that's fuel efficient. So I think we need to think through how to help those folks not only contribute to a healthier environment, but also help them keep their costs down with a, you know, a more fuel efficient car. And, you know, so we just need to keep that in mind that, you know, it's not, some people would like to do good for the environment, just like some people would like to eat healthier, but it's way cheaper to eat junk food yeah. and to go to McDonald's than it is to go to a farmer's market and eat really high quality food. Well, we want everybody to have access to those high quality foods and high quality apparatuses that make their world go around.
Yeah, I agree completely. And you made a reference to this a little earlier that's along the same line. And that is that there are going to be industries that are adversely affected as we make these changes. And we can't just throw those industries under the bus as we go along. We do have to pay attention to them, and we have to help with these transitions. And the transitions we're called upon to make are really, really fast. I mean, some transitions have happened over time and people have had a chance to adapt. This is not so much the case there. So
when you're thinking, I completely agree. Because when you're thinking about these industries, I think a lot of people, it's real easy to vilify a big corporation. You know, you look at the logo, you look at the name, you're like, oh, they're not doing right by our environment. And they may or may not be that could be the case. But we have to remember they employ our neighbors mm-hmm. and our family members. And so it's so important to our economy, but also to the livelihoods of our of our friends and neighbors that we, to the extent possible, we work with these businesses to say, okay, this is where we're headed. The writing is on the wall, or the legislation is already passed. This is where we've got to get to. How can we help you get there? And how can we help, you know, these jobs transition, if they need to, and a lot of them do, into really good living wage, green jobs? What new training do you need? What new equipment or technology, or, you know, what new setup do you need so that we can help you get there? Because it's to all of our advantage.
Yeah, well put and well summed up. Well, we're getting close to the end here. I've learned a significant amount from talking to you, and I certainly pick up on your energy and your passion for helping people, and having a part of that help is having a healthy environment, as you point out. It's absolutely true. So just a little bit about the politics for you on the council itself. So there's going to be two parties represented on the council. I mean, we know that pretty much going in here. So what are your thoughts about working with people who may have distinctly different views on some of these environmental issues from what you have?
You know, I first of all, it's okay. It's okay to have different opinions. And one of the quotes that I hear Derek Kilmer say a lot that I love is that neither party has the monopoly on good ideas. And I appreciate that. And I appreciate even the extremes, because I think it helps us get to the best policy. And even though I might not agree with a particular counterpart's view, there might be something in there that I, you know, I'll recognize, like, you know, but she or he has a point there. And I hadn't considered how this affected, you know, this location or this business or this this community. So there are valid points, I think, and everybody, what everybody is saying, that we need to respect. On city council, one of the things I love and will miss should I be elected is that city council is nonpartisan. And, you know, we're not supposed to know, I guess, where people are, but we do in terms of politically. And some of my best allies are not in the same political party as I am. And I love that. And I think the community sees that and appreciates that we can come together, because, you know, parks and parking and traffic and a lot of these things, they can become partisan, but they should not be partisan. And so, you know, it's something I'm good at. I'm good at working together. I love to sit down and listen. And there are things from both sides that we can incorporate to create stronger policy. And, you know, I'll just point out, the folks from the other party that were elected by just as many people who elected me. So they are representing a group of folks in Pierce County that deserve a voice and deserve to be listened to, just like the people that might have voted for me in my district, or the people that didn't vote for me in my district. I'm going to listen to everybody and make sure that we're thinking of everybody in our decision.
Yeah, you're pointing towards listening, I think, is such an important thing. I could learn more to do that better. I think in our culture, we could learn to do that better. And one of the things that I believe I heard you say is, as you listen to somebody, you're listening for things, that their perspectives or their ideas that you see value in. And I know that in our culture, it's traditional when there's an aspect of different perspectives, that as we listen, we're listening to rebut what the other person is saying, rather than listening for the value of what they have to say. I read a book many years ago that had a quote in it that I've never forgotten. The woman that wrote this book said, when you're listening to somebody else, always be asking yourself, what could be true about what this person is saying? And I think that that's really wonderful advice. So, and you mentioned Derek Kilmer. I just want to toss out, too, that I think I saw that Derek Kilmer has endorsed your candidacy. Is that right?
Yes, Derek Kilmer has endorsed my candidacy, and he did it really early, too, which I was so honored. And then, of course, Derek Young. Derek Young, it's his position that I'm going for. He's terming out. I always tell everybody I'm not running against him. He actually asked me to run over a year ago, and it took me a while to decide, because I knew I would love the job. I knew I'd love the job, but, you know, I'm single income household. So I had to kind of think of my kids, and I had to take that long-term view about what this was going to mean for my life and the life of my kids. And then once I decided, I was all in, and I'm, as you can tell, I'm very excited.
Yeah. Well, I belong to Citizens Climate Lobby, and we work with Derek Kilmer a lot. We've had a lot of conversations with him. In fact, he took our regional CCL facilitator back to the State of the Union last year, which is an example of the positive relationship we have with him. And so a part of me is like, well, if Derek Kilmer endorses somebody, that's all I need to know about that person. But at the same time, it is nice to know some more. So anything else we should talk about before we finish up here, Robin?
Oh my gosh, there's so much we could talk about. I will just make one note about Derek Kilmer is we really appreciate the work he's doing on the culvert replacement funding from the federal government, because I am so passionate about having healthy creeks and a healthy salmon population. But those culverts, as a city council person, those culverts are incredibly expensive to replace. We're having to build, you know, 50-foot bridges, these millions and millions of dollars, and we must do it. I mean, ethically and environmentally and legally, we must do it. So the assistance from the federal government on that is so appreciated.
Yeah, I hear you on that. And I think that earlier we were talking about short-term and long-term. And I think this culvert issue is a great example of the costs long-term if things aren't done thoughtfully on the short-term. And so a lesson to be learned for all of us in there. Well, Robin, I've really loved having this conversation with you. Wish you well in your candidacy, and I'll look forward to us talking again, let's say sometime after the primary in August. How does that sound?
I would love to, because there's lots more to talk about. It was, was so fun, John. Thank you.
Yeah, you're certainly welcome. Thank you. So yes, election's coming up. It's up to us to be informed, to find climate-aware politicians to vote for, to ask questions, to let candidates know what our concerns are. Sometimes it can seem formidable to approach candidates, but my experience is they love to hear from voters. So just do it. If you have candidates you'd like to hear in conversation on Climate Talk, drop me a note at John, J-O-H-N, at ccltacoma.org, and I'll invite them. The CCL part is for Citizens Climate Lobby. I'm an activist with Citizens Climate Lobby. It's a good outfit. Check it out. A reminder that this program, along with all locally produced programs, are archived on the KTAH website. Just do an internet search for KTAH, find programming on that site, and you'll find the archives there. That's it for today, reminding you, live like the mountain is out. Take care now.